Well, hello out there, and welcome to Endeavors, broadcasting to you from wherever you are, wherever you may be going, or wherever you may have been. Glad you could be with me today. It's going to be a very informative show, very moving show, but also a lot of fun, too. We have journalist and author Johan Hari. He studies addiction, and he gave a very, very fascinating TED Talk not too long ago called Why Everything You Think You Know About Addiction Is Wrong. And he also has a book out called Chasing the Scream. You may remember a couple episodes back, I had on neuroscientist Mark Lewis, and he looked at it. He was a former addict himself, and then he looked at addiction from a scientific point of view. And while Johan Hari does a little bit of that, he more investigates it from a journalistic perspective. So the contrast is nice, even though there are also a lot of similarities. You'll also hear from Montreal filmmaker Sophie Deraspe. She has a new documentary out called The Amina Profile. You may remember a couple of years ago, a few years ago in 2011, there was quite a well-known blog called Gay Girl in Damascus, which was supposedly about a lesbian woman living in Syria, and it brought attention to a lot of the problems that were in that area. And of course, it was revealed later that the blog was a hoax started by a white American man living in Edinburgh. Sophie was friends with Sandra, the woman who Amina had started an online relationship with. So Sophie Deraspe, the filmmaker, was sort of living this as it happened, and that's when she decided to turn it into a documentary. And it's very, very good. I must say I had a chance to see it. You'll also hear from New Brunswick singer-songwriter and self-described folk trash artist, Lisa LeBlanc. She has a great EP out called Highways, Heartaches, and Time Well Wasted. And that's where we will start today. This is her song, You Look Like Trouble, But I Guess I Do Too.
The smell of your old cigarette has stayed on my coat, and even though I find it kind of gross, it somehow comforts me. The great thing about us is that we're practically the same, and you know that's what scares me the most. My heart's always traveled with me in my suitcase, and I guess I don't want to see it ending up in yours. Well, you look like trouble, but I guess I do too. Well, you look like trouble, but I guess I do too. Gypsy's heart can't settle down, so if you don't mind me asking, what do we do now? 'Cause I have to admit, even the highways don't look the same since you've been around. Well, you look like trouble, but I guess I do too. Well, you look like trouble, but I guess I do.
that was Lisa LeBlanc with You Look Like Trouble, But I Guess I Do Too, off her album Highways, Heartaches, and Time Well Wasted. Later on, you will be hearing my conversation with Lisa LeBlanc. But my first guest is a journalist from England and originally born in Glasgow, Scotland. He has written for many of the world's leading newspapers, including New York Times, Le Monde, The Guardian, The New Republic, Slate, and The Independent, for which he was lead op-ed columnist for 9 years. He graduated from King's College with a double degree in social and political science in 2001. He has been named Amnesty International's National Newspaper Journalist of the Year twice, and was named Environmental Commentator of the Year at the Editorial Intelligence Awards and Gay Journalist of the Year at the Stonewall Awards. He's also won the Martha Gellhorn Prize for political writing. He has long studied addiction and its effects and wrote a book called Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs, which has been liked by both Elton John and Noam Chomsky. He is Johan Hari, and I got to speak with him a couple of weeks back. Johan Hari, thanks so much for being here. Welcome to the show.
That's great to be with you, Danny. Thanks for having me.
So you recently did a TED Talk saying why everything you know about addiction is wrong. What first started you down the path of researching addiction?
I don't want to suck up to the people of Canada just because I'm on a Canadian radio station, but actually a huge amount of what I learned in Canada, particularly in Vancouver. And actually a really important part of my book, Chasing the Scream, is about Canada and about some really extraordinary Canadians who I think every Canadian should be proud of. But my journey into this started a very different place. One of my earliest memories is of trying to wake up one of my relatives and not being able to. And I was very young then, so I didn't understand why. But as I got older, I realised we had drug addiction in my family. And when I started working on this book about 4 years ago, it was partly because I realised we were coming up to 100 years since drugs were first banned in the US, in Britain and in Canada. And, you know, I kind of thought of myself as someone who knew quite a lot about these issues, partly because, you know, like because of my family, partly because as a journalist I'd written about the drug war and addiction quite a lot for about 10 years, and partly, you know, mainly for those reasons. But I kind of suddenly realised that there were loads of incredibly basic questions I just didn't know the answers to, like, you know, why did we go to war against drug addicts 100 years ago? Why are we carrying on with this approach when it clearly isn't working? What are the actual alternatives like in practice? Where has tried them? And what really causes drug use and drug addiction? And I couldn't really find the answers in what I was reading, so I decided to go on a journey to sit with people whose lives have been changed one way or another by this approach or by the alternatives. And I didn't realise when I set off quite how long a journey it would be. I ended up going to what is now a dozen countries, over 30,000 miles, and meeting just an incredible mixture of people, from a transgender crack dealer in Brownsville, Brooklyn, who I got to know over 3 years, to a hitman for the deadliest Mexican drug cartel, to a guy who was kept at the bottom of a well for 2.5 years and emerged to lead his country, become president and become the first president to legalize marijuana, to actually the only country to ever decriminalize all drugs, from cannabis to crack, with incredible results. And I guess the main thing I learned is almost everything we think we know about this subject is wrong. Drugs are not what we think they are. Addiction is not what we think it is. The drug war is not what we've seen on our TV screens for such a long time. And the alternatives to the drug war aren't what we think they are. So it's a really exciting time when almost everything we think we know is wrong.
I was speaking a couple weeks ago with neuroscientist Mark Lewis, who also has a book out about addiction. And one of his things is that he subscribes to the choice theory, where addiction is a choice, but a choice that you're forced into based on, you know, the circumstance and nature versus nurture. Do you subscribe to that argument at all?
I don't find debates about free will interesting ever. I studied philosophy at university, and I always found it a kind of slightly pointless debate. I'll tell you how I approached this, and it was the thing that most blew my mind in what I learned from my book. If you had said to me 4 years ago, what causes heroin addiction, for example, I would have looked at you like you were a little bit stupid. And I would say, well, obviously, it's a stupid question. Heroin causes heroin addiction, right? We've been told a story for 100 years. It's our common sense. It's obviously certainly my common sense. You know, we think if the first 10 people to listen to this podcast all used heroin together for a month, they'd all become heroin addicts, because there are chemical hooks in heroin that your body would start to physically need. And when you were deprived of those chemical hooks, you would kind of have a ravenous hunger for them. And that's what addiction is. The first thing that alerted me to the fact that saying not right about that is when I came to interview Gabor Mate, a great Canadian doctor who'd worked with addicts for many years, and explained to me, if I step out of this interview now and I get hit by a truck and I break my hip, I'll be taken to hospital and I'll be given loads of a drug called diamorphine. Diamorphine is heroin. It's just the medical name for heroin. The stuff you're given in hospital is actually much stronger than the stuff you'll buy on the streets, because obviously the stuff you get from dealers is cut and contaminated. Actually, only a small amount of it is actually heroin, whereas obviously the doctors give you the real deal. They give you the pure stuff. Now, anyone listening to this, there are loads of people near you who are being given loads of heroin in hospital the whole time. If your grandmother has ever had a hip replacement operation, she's been given loads of heroin. If what we think about addiction is right, what should happen to those people? They're exposed to all the same chemical hooks as any addict you'll see in the street. Some of them, at least, should become addicts. This has been studied very carefully. It doesn't happen. Now, you will have noticed your grandmother was not turned into a junkie by her hip replacement, right? Now, when I learned that, it just seemed so weird and so contrary to everything I knew that I didn't understand it. And I only really began to understand it when I went and met another amazing person in Vancouver. I don't want to overstate it, but I think one of the greatest living Canadians, an extraordinary professor of psychology called Bruce Alexander. And Bruce explained to me, the theory of addiction we have in our heads comes in part from a series of experiments that were done earlier in the 20th century. They're really simple experiments. Your listeners can do them at home if they're feeling a bit sadistic. You get a rat and you put it in a cage and you give it two water bottles. One is just water and the other is water laced with either heroin or cocaine. If you do that, the rat will almost always prefer the drugged water and almost always kill itself quite quickly. So there you go, right? That's our theory of addiction. But in the 70s, Professor Alexander was looking at these experiments and he kind of thought, well, hang on a minute, we're putting these rats in an empty cage. They've got nothing to do except drink this water. How would this work if we did it differently? So he built a cage that he called Rat Park, which is basically heaven for rats, right? Anything a rat can want in life, it's got a Rat Park. It's got cheese, it's got coloured balls, it's got tunnels to scamper around. And crucially, it's got loads of friends, it can have loads of sex. And they've got both the water bottles, the normal water and the drugged water. But this is the fascinating thing. In Rat Park, they don't like the drugged water. They almost never use it. None of them ever use it compulsively. None of them ever overdose. So bear in mind, they go from almost 100% overdose when they're isolated to no overdose when they have strong connections and friends and stuff to do. Now, I think this has huge human implications. There are loads of human experiments demonstrating that. But I think it forces us to think about addiction differently. What if it's not the chemical hooks? What if it's your cage? What if addiction is largely an adaptation to your environment? There's a professor in Amsterdam called Peter Cohen who says, you know, we shouldn't even call it addiction, we should call it bonding. Human beings have an innate need to bond and connect. And when we're happy and healthy, we'll bond and connect with each other. But if you can't do that because you're isolated or traumatized or beaten down by life, you're going to bond and connect with something that gives you some sense of relief. That might be porn, that might be gambling, that might be crack, it might be alcohol. But you will bond and connect with something because that's our nature. That's our innate human nature.
You had mentioned heroin, and there's a program here in Vancouver where we basically give low doses of high-grade pure heroin to addicts. And what we've seen is that it's actually weaning them off their addiction. Is that a program you think that's a good idea, is feeding junkies with their own drug?
I definitely wouldn't put it like that. I think we've got to look at the places that have done this. Vancouver has a small program. Switzerland has a big program, and I went and looked at this in a lot of detail. Switzerland has legalized heroin for addicts, and it's really important to understand why. The first place to do it actually was the Wirral, which is a place in the north of England. And I tell the story in Chasing the Scream of how that happened. It's a really fascinating story. In the early 1980s, this doctor, a Welsh doctor called John Marks, arrived on the Wirral, which is a very economically depressed place. Not quite the downtown east side, but not that far off, right? It's a kind of former industrial place where the industry was all gone and there was just real despair. And he turned up, and one of the first, he was working in a practice with other general doctors. And one of the things they said is, oh, you can be in charge of the addicts. And seems like fine. It wasn't particularly an interest of his, but he thought, okay, I can do that. And he calls in, and as he starts to meet the addicts in the surgery, he discovers something that absolutely astonishes him, which is that heroin was being prescribed to the local heroin addicts, about 60 of them. And John Marks was completely baffled by this. He phrased it the way you did, you know, what on earth are they doing, giving junkies heroin? Why would you do that? And he called in the addicts with a mind to say, this was, by the way, this had been shut down everywhere else in the world, but in Britain, in some small pockets, it was shut down in the 1930s. It used to happen quite often. It was shut down, basically the American government forced everywhere in the world to stop doing it. But in Britain, doctors had quite a high degree of autonomy, so they had just said, screw you, we're going to carry on doing this. Anyway, John Marks called in these addicts to say, look, the party's over, we've got to stop this. And what he saw really surprised him. These addicts came in, and they looked nothing like any of the heroin addicts he'd ever seen anywhere else. They all had jobs. They didn't have any abscesses or any wounds. They didn't appear to be profoundly debilitated. And he began to talk to them, and he then started doing a lot of research, and he discovered that a huge number of the things that we associate with heroin addiction, in fact, have nothing to do with heroin addiction. They're the result of prohibiting heroin addiction. So, for example, abscesses and wounds, which are very common among heroin addicts in the United States, don't happen when you give heroin legally, because those are all the result of the contaminants in the drug that are put there by drug dealers, because obviously you can't inspect, you know, inspect the work of criminals. They don't have any incentive to make their product good or pure, or using in dirty and insanitary conditions. Actually, those stop. What he also found is when it was prescribed to addicts, the scramble to pay this hugely inflated street price, which meant that a lot of women prostituted themselves, a lot of men committed property crime, just stopped. Obviously, you don't want to have sex with lots of strangers if you don't have to in order to get your drug. And overwhelmingly, most of them had normal jobs and normal lives. And as he got to know these patients and was really blown away by this, he thought, you know, what we should do is we should expand this program if this works so well. So they started to significantly expand the program from 60 to, I think it was around 600 in that area. And what happened in that area was extraordinary. The biggest champions of it were the police. There was a 93% fall in burglary. The local supermarket chain, Marks and Spencer's, which is a bit like the kind of Whole Foods of Britain, they offered to sponsor a conference to do this nationally because the rate of shoplifting in their stores fell down so dramatically. The chief of police said you would see people going into this program who looked like wrecks, who looked like skeletons. And after a few months, you'd just see they looked like normal people with jobs like everyone else. The program was hugely successful. There were no deaths from overdose from people on the program, none. John Marks, the doctor doing this, who I got to know and I interviewed for my book, started to travel around the United States to promote this, saying this would be a good thing to do in the US. And then all hell fell down on him. The American embassy started to massively pressure the British government, and the conservative British government shut the program down. And Bear in mind, from 1983 to 1995, when John was running the program and the prescription program was in place, they had no deaths from heroin overdose. In the next 6 months, 40 of the people on that program died of heroin overdoses or heroin-related problems. And then the program ended. But some Swiss doctors had come and seen that program and they were inspired by it. And they went back to Switzerland and they made the case in Switzerland where they had a big heroin problem to do this. And amazingly, there was actually a referendum in Switzerland, which is a really conservative country. And 70% of people voted to keep that program, a prescription for heroin addicts. And I went to the clinics in Geneva where they do this. The only thing I would I would slightly add to your question is, you talked about, you know, it's a way of getting them off the drug. I think it's slightly more complicated than that. So on the Swiss program, and I went to the clinic in Geneva, you turn up, you're given your heroin legally, you can't take it out with you, you've got to use it there. So they wanted to make sure people didn't just sell it on the streets. And then overwhelmingly, you go off to your job. Because the vast majority of addicts, when the chaos ends, get jobs, get their lives together, give them support and help to make sure they've got housing and all of that stuff. But one of the things they really surprised me is you can stay on that program as long as you want and you can set your own dose. They won't give you a dose that would kill you, but anything other than that, they'll give you. And I was kind of surprised by that. I thought, well, that's a bit, you know, it's kind of liberal. But actually, Rita Mangi, the wonderful psychiatrist who runs that clinic, explained to me, when people's lives start to improve and, you know, their lives get better, overwhelmingly the vast majority of people choose over time with no pressure on them to reduce their dose because they want to be present in their lives more. I think the absolute core of understanding addiction is that it's about not being able to bear to be present in your life because your life is too painful. Anyone who has difficulty understanding that, you know, I've got in front of me while I'm talking to you a can of Pepsi Light. Right, you've probably got a drink in front of you. Totally legally, forget the drug laws. We could both be drinking vodka now, right? We could probably, you know, you and I probably got enough money, we could drink vodka for the next month and we wouldn't end up homeless, right? We could just be constantly drunk on vodka. We're not going to do that. Not because anyone's stopping us, but because we want to be present in our lives. We've got people we want to hang out with. We've got jobs we want to do. We've got, you know, books we want to read. We've got stuff we want to be present for. The core of addiction is about not being able to deal with that because your life is unbearable. Either the internal or external pain is unbearable. That's the lesson of Rat Park. There's loads of examples of this. And one of the cores of the heroin programs, why they work, is because the unbearable pain of being homeless or being in a state of chaos or being forced to prostitute yourself ends, you start to turn your life around. And as your life gets better, you want to be present in your life more. And most people will cut back on their use. Now, I would say, even if they don't cut back on their use, even if they stay on legal heroin for their whole lives, that's an awful lot better than being on prohibited heroin for your whole life, which kills you for all sorts of reasons, because of the contaminants and the drugs, because of the terrible life you have if you're scrambling to get the hugely inflated amount of money the criminals will charge for it. So I don't think the priority, it's a good thing if we can bring people back to us, if we can, you know, if they choose to reduce their dose, but I think the priority is making sure they don't die, and the second thing is that their life gets better, and most people when their lives get better will choose to reduce their dose. But that's not the, that shouldn't be the kind of overall goal. The crucial goal is that they have decent lives and that they don't die.
Of course, you mentioned the police here, and I know here in Vancouver and BC, many chiefs of police and governor generals and attorneys generals have all called for the legalization of marijuana. Do we need to take it one step further and legalize all drugs? It seems to me that if we do that, governments could actually make more money than they're currently spending fighting it on the war on drugs.
Yes, but I think you're totally right, Danny. I think it's important, though, to understand that legalization means different things for different drugs. I don't quite know the laws about this in Vancouver, but I'm pretty sure you could go and you could own, if you wanted to, a dog, a monkey, and a lion. But I'm pretty sure there'll be different legal rules for each of them. So I'm sure with a dog, you can just go to a store and buy one. With a monkey, you'd probably need a license. And for a lion, I'm sure they'd come and, like, inspect your home, and, you know, you couldn't just have a lion in your yard, right? And I think so there's lots of things in life where we have things that are legal, but they're differently legal according to their risk. And I think that's what we should do with all drugs. It's important to understand the worst thing about the drug war, I think, is not what we do to addicts and users, or obviously I think that's appalling. It's a whole other thing which causes a complete disaster, which is if you ban drugs, they don't disappear. They're transferred from the people who used to control them in Vancouver and everywhere else pharmacists and doctors to armed criminal gangs. And those armed criminal gangs do all sorts of things we've talked about. One of the problems that they cause, which is that they contaminate the product, they make it radically more dangerous. But there's actually, I think, by far the most urgent moral issue surrounding this, which is the violence involved in the trade, which I learned about, as I say, from interviewing, you know, getting to know very well a transgender crack dealer in Brownsville, Brooklyn, Chino Hardin, who had the most incredible story that I tell in Chasing the Scream, and Rosalio Retta, who was a hitman for the deadliest Mexican drug cartel, Los Zetas, who I also got to know, whose story I tell in Chasing the Scream as well. But I think if you want to understand why it causes violence, and this is widely misunderstood, there's a really simple way of thinking about it, right? If you and me, after this interview, if you find what I'm saying so depressing that you decide you want to steal a bottle of vodka, if you go to your local liquor store and you try and they catch you, they'll call the cops and the cops will come and take you away. So that liquor store doesn't need to be violent. It doesn't need to be intimidating. You know, they don't need to be armed to the teeth or anything like that. They've got the force of the law behind them to protect their property rights. If, however, you decided you want to steal some weed or some coke, and the guy in your neighbourhood who sells that catches you, obviously he can't call the cops, right? The cops would come and arrest him. He has to fight you. Now, you don't want to be having a fight every day. So you have to establish a reputation for being such a terrifying badass that no one would dare to do that, that it would be an extremely foolish thing to do that. So in a prohibited market, you protect your trade and you establish your trade and you maintain your trade through acts of violence and terror, right? That's how it works. And Milton Friedman, the Nobel Prize winning economist, calculated there are an additional 10,000 murders every year in the United States as a direct result of that dynamic. There are fights going on the whole time in Vancouver. You know, I remember when I was there, the conflict in the Hells Angels and all of that. Lots of people in the United States get killed in the crossfire. Lots of cops get killed. Lots of dealers get killed. Lots of completely innocent people get killed. And by the way, that's bad enough in a place like Vancouver. In a place like northern Mexico, where I went, it's unimaginably horrific. 160,000 people have been killed or disappeared in the last 8 years, entirely due to this dynamic. Sometimes on the news, this is called drug-related violence. And I think it's a really misleading phrase, because what people picture is someone using drugs, going crazy and attacking someone, right? That's what they think it means. That does happen sometimes. It's about 7% of what's called drug-related violence. The rest, the overwhelming majority, is what I'm describing. It's violence between rival criminal groups to control the trade. Al Capone wasn't getting drunk and shooting people, right? He was, he was killing people to protect his trade in a prohibited market in alcohol. If you want to understand what happens after prohibition ends, ask yourself, where are the violent alcohol dealers now? You know, does the head of Heineken send the head of Smirnoff to go and shoot? You know, to go and kill the head of Smirnoff. No, of course not. It doesn't happen. Alcohol hasn't changed. What's happened is the system of regulating it has changed. So you're totally right. When you regulate, the most important thing you do is you bankrupt these armed criminal gangs. There are no violent alcohol dealers anymore. They don't exist. The second thing you do, which is the thing you mentioned, is you can tax it. And you can use that money to have programs that really do turn people's lives around. None of this is hypothetical. I've been to places that have done that, and I can tell you about them if you want. But I think you're totally right that legalization of drugs is the way to go. You know, we've had 100 years of an experiment in the alternative. We can see the results all around us. We've spent $1 trillion, untold numbers of lives, 100 years, and we can't even keep drugs out of our prisons where we, you know, pay someone to go around the armed perimeter the whole time, right? Like, that tells you how well it's worked.
You mentioned off the top of the interview about Gabor Mate, who's a bit of a legend here in Vancouver. For his work with addiction. And if the one thing I'm fascinated with him about is his work with ayahuasca, this sort of Peruvian tea, I guess you could call it. What did you learn from Dr. Mate, and how do you think maybe other people can follow in his lead in terms of changing the conversation about drugs and addiction?
So I think you're right. I think what Gabor's doing with hallucinogens is fascinating. There's a whole emerging body of research that suggests that hallucinogens are very effective at reducing addiction. This actually, we kind of knew this up till 1965. There was quite a lot of research into this. There was quite good evidence that LSD was quite effective in reducing alcoholism. And then it's all shut down by the drug war, and that research just ends and never starts again. But Gabor, has been doing some of this research. There's fascinating research coming out of Johns Hopkins University in particular. I'm actually going to go and meet the guys in Baltimore in a few weeks who've been doing this research. And and I think the core, there's still a lot we don't know, but I think the core of this, of understanding why that's happening, is because it's related to what we were saying before about Rat Park and connection. One of the things I keep saying is the opposite of addiction is not sobriety. The opposite of addiction is connection. In Rat Park, where the rats had connections, where they had each other, where they had loving relationships insofar as rats can have such things, they didn't want to be out of it all the time. They wanted to be present in their lives. They didn't want to be addicted. When they were isolated and disconnected and alone, they used their drugs compulsively because there was no other source of relief or pleasure in their lives. And one of the things we know about hallucinogens, and anyone who's tried them will tell you, is they increase your sense of connectedness with the wider universe, with the world. They increase your sense that you're not alone, that you're part of this complex and dense tapestry. Now, there are other ways of helping people to be connected to the wider world. Gabor did wonderful work with addicts on the Downtown East Side, showing such love and affection for them that also helped. But actually, I would look at, and it's related to your previous question as well, Danny, what happened in Portugal, where they did a huge amount to increase connection, and they did exactly what you said before about using the money. So in Portugal in the year 2000, they had one of the worst drug problems in Europe. 1% of the population was addicted to heroin, which is kind of extraordinary. And every year they tried the American way more. They arrested more people, they imprisoned more people. And every year the problem got worse. And one day the prime minister and the leader of the opposition got together and they basically said, look, we can't carry on like this. We can't have, you know, ever more people in our country being addicted to smack. What are we going to do? And they decided to set up a panel of scientists and doctors. And they said to this panel, go away. Look at all the best evidence into this and come back and tell us what would genuinely solve the problem. And we will have agreed in advance that we'll do whatever you recommend. And so they went away and they looked at all the stuff about Rat Park and lots of other evidence. They were led by this extraordinary man called Juan Gulao, who I got to know, who's a doctor. And they came back and they said, decriminalize all drugs from cannabis to crack. But, and this is the crucial next step, take all the money we used to spend on arresting and imprisoning drug addicts and spend it instead on turning their lives around, on reconnecting them with the society. And it's interesting, that wasn't really what we think of as, as drug treatment in Canada and Britain and the US. So they do a bit of rehab and some psychological support that does have some value. But actually what they did is the exact opposite. They took the money they used to spend on prisons and policing, and they spent it instead on a huge job creation program. So say you used to be a mechanic. They'd go to a garage and they'll say, if you employ this guy for a year, we'll pay half his wages. They set up a huge program of microloans for addicts to set up small businesses that they ran themselves. The goal was to make sure that every addict in Portugal had something to get out of bed for in the morning. And the results were fascinating. You know, when I went there, it was 13 years since the experiment had begun. It's 15 years this year. And injecting drug use is down in Portugal by 50%, 50%. Deaths from overdose are massively down. HIV transmission among addicts is massively down. Street crime is massively down. One of the ways you know it worked really well is that almost no one wants to go back in Portugal. They've got five main political parties and none of them want to go back. I went and interviewed João Figueira, this guy who led the opposition to the decriminalisation when it happened. He's the top drug cop in Portugal. And he said to me, everything I said would happen didn't happen. And everything the other side said would happen did. And he talked about how he felt ashamed that he'd spent 20 years arresting and harassing addicts. And he hoped the whole world followed his example. And I think that's really related to the stuff about hallucinogens, because what we find is every approach you try that's about disconnecting and punishing addicts and making them feel more pain doesn't just fail, it makes addiction worse. Every approach you try that's about reconnecting addicts with the society, with the wider world, giving them a sense of connection, reduces their addiction over time. It doesn't work for everyone. There are still some addicts in Portugal. There's still tragedies. But you get a really significant fall in addiction if you do that.
Well, the book is Chasing the Scream, The First and Last Days of the War on Drugs. And you can watch Johan's TED Talk, Why Everything You Know About Addiction Is Wrong. Johan Hari, it's a fascinating discussion, fascinating research. Thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate doing it, Danny. Cheers.
Cheers.
Oh, I should just say to everyone that if they want any more information about the book, they can go to the book's website, www.chasingthescream.com, and there's like a quiz you can take there to find out how much you really know about the war on drugs, and you can listen to the audio for the interviews of people I mentioned and loads of other exciting stuff. You can also find out why it's the only book that's ever been praised by both Noam Chomsky and Elton John, although they refused to sing a duet in its honour, which upset me. Yeah, so that's all on the www.chasingthescream.com.
Chasingthescream.com. Perfect. Johan Hari, thank you.
Cheers, Danny.
Cheers. Thanks so much. Addiction comes in many forms, drugs just being one of a multitude of substances. But a more dangerous one, perhaps the single most dangerous one, is guns. Alison Parker, Andy Ward. Those were the two victims of the shooting in Virginia last week. Unlike many previous events, however, this happened live on air on television. The gunman was a disgruntled former employee of the station who clearly had some stuff going on inside his head. Much like the war on drugs, we need to start treating guns and those who commit mass violence as a mental health problem rather than a criminal one. We can't just keep dismissing all of them as being perpetrated by whack jobs, only if they are white, it seems. 90% of gun owners want regulation, yet Congress thinks doing nothing is the way to go. We've had our own mass shootings here in Canada. The Montreal Massacre comes to mind. Yet, because we understand the importance of life, we banded together across political lines and worked to create a safer society. This does not mean we confiscated every single gun in the country. Rather, you now have to have a license, a background check, and a registration process to obtain one. Hunters and collectors still get to keep their weapons, yet we are also able to rid the streets and homes of military-style high-magazine automatic weapons. England did the same after Dunblane. So did Australia. In 2013, Canada's homicide rate was at the lowest it's been since 1966. Clearly, something is working. The more we start framing the conversation about mental health rather than about good guys versus bad guys, the sooner progress will be made. Okay, here's Lisa LeBlanc with Gold Diggin' Hoedown.
Why?
Once again, that was Gold Digging Hoedown by Lisa LeBlanc off her album Highways, Heartaches, and Time Well Wasted. But who exactly is she? Lisa is an Acadian-Canadian singer from New Brunswick. Acadian is, of course, a distinct part of our Canadian culture. And this self-described folk trash artist epitomizes it. And her mini-album, Highways, Heartaches, and Time Well Wasted, is proof of her amazing creativity. The six-song EP features five of her original tunes and one cover song, Katie Cruel, an old traditional Scottish folk song that was popularized by the great blues singer Karen Dalton. I had a chance to speak with Lisa about her album and her love of Karen Dalton earlier in the week. Lisa LeBlanc, thanks so much for joining me. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you.
The new album is Highways, Heartaches, and Time Well Wasted. And I feel like this is a road album, if there ever was one. It's like a musical road movie. How did being on the road for so long inspire you creatively and bring forth this album?
I was gone for like a month and a half. I did this road trip for fun in the States, so that was for like a month and a half. But like before that, we were touring like crazy for like, I don't know, 3, 4, 5, 6 years. So the highways are something that I know very well. And I've been on the road for quite some time, and I love it. It's something that I find very inspiring, and I love how huge just like Canada is, and just traveling and, you know, all over the place. So it's been really inspiring just to like kind of, and yeah, so that album just kind of like came out of a couple adventures, whatever.
Singing in English, was that something that you were already planning to do?
No, actually, I started out in English like a lot of people, but I'm francophone, as you can tell. And I started out, but just quickly turned to French, and I was the first one to say like, no, I'm not gonna write in English. I'm really bad at this. Like, I'm you know, choose your battles. I'll stick to French. And all of a sudden, this tune just popped out of nowhere. And another one, and I didn't really know what to do with it. I didn't really want to do a full album either. But so this whole idea of EP after that first album that we traveled a lot with was just kind of like a very natural and like, well, hey, why not? Let's do this.
How different is it for you writing and performing in English than it is in French?
I like both for, I guess, different reasons. Well, I think for me, French is maybe a little more natural because it's my native tongue. So, I mean, it's a lot of automatic writing, and it's a lot of, like, no-filter stuff. And I also speak this kind of dialect that's called Chiac, and it's a mix of French and English, and that's, like, the whole New Brunswick thing, like the Acadians, like southeast New Brunswick, we speak that dialect. So, I mean, I kind of use that in the tune, so it's just, you know, natural. But in English, it's challenging. I just kind of like to screw around, and it's like a little bit more research. I like both, but it's just another challenge, and it's another way to, it's a new language, so I mean, it's like more weapons, I guess, to write, and it's, both are inspiring in, yeah, different ways.
And yet you made an interesting choice, because if I'm correct, the title track off your EP is an instrumental.
Yeah.
When you were writing that tune originally, did you know that it wasn't going to have any words to it? And does that change your approach at all when writing, do you think?
The instrumental, I started out as just like a random riff that I did, and all of a sudden I kind of figured, like, hey, I've never done any instrumentals, and I remember my mom being like, why don't you do an instrumental? You can play some guitar. And it's been like a couple of years since she's been asking me to do an instrumental, and I figured, well, hey, why not? I've never done it, and it actually fit pretty well, because that instrumental was really inspired when I was in when I was doing this road trip. I was in Texas. I was driving from Texas to Louisiana, and I just remember, like, the scenery and being like, well, this is pretty much the good place for a spaghetti western tune. Like, this is pretty perfect. So it kind of came from there, and I just, like, remember being by myself and driving and starting my road to come back home. So there was just something about it, and I just had this moment where I was like, okay, I think this is kind of this is pretty cool what's happening right now. I think I have to remember this. Like, this is, I don't know, I think I've accomplished something, and it was really great. So it just kind of, like, yeah, so that's how the whole album title and that tune just came to me.
I feel like there are two songs on the album which for me sort of encapsulate the whole attitude of the project, and it's Gold Digging Hoedown and You Look Like Trouble But I Guess I Do Too. What can you tell us about those two tracks?
You Look Like Trouble But I Guess I Do Too is, well, kind of self-explanatory. pretty self-explanatory, and it's actually the first tune that was written for the EP. I was doing this kind of, like, artist residency, just kind of, like, hanging out at one of my buddies has this bed and breakfast in St. Andrews, and I went there for another, like, last couple of years ago, like, I don't know, like a week, and just kind of wrote and hung out, and it's a really inspiring place. So I went back like 2 years ago with one of my friends, and we just wrote, and whatever would come out, at least we were writing something. So it was just like, let's make something happen, even if it's bad, even if whatever happens. And this tune just kind of popped out, and that kind of started the whole project. And for Goldie and Hoedown, it's an actual scene that I saw in Nashville. And I just kind of, like, went into a bar, and I saw this guy who was, like, I swear to God, kind of like Hugh Hefner, but in a Nashville form. And it was just I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. I was like, this is a movie. I have to write something about this. This guy is perfect, and he had, like, his posse with him, and his, obviously, well, maybe a girlfriend or an escort, I don't know, I'll never know. And so that's kind of how that tune came to be.
Would you say that you have a concrete writing process? How fluid is that for you?
It always changes. It's never really the same. Sometimes it's just like automatic writing, and then a riff kind of pops out after. Sometimes there's a riff that been lying around for months, and I just kind of hear it again, or I start writing something and I'm like, oh, I'll check out some old riffs and something's gonna match up. It's never really the same, it's always changing, but writing for me is something that's maybe harder than performing. Like, my favorite thing on earth is performing, but writing for me is a little tougher, just because it's just like it takes me a really long time to finish a song. It can be, you know, a month, or if I'm really lucky, it'll take 3 days, but usually it takes months in, like, obsessing over it. Just, it's not like a zen process. So that's my writing process, but,
You also include a cover song on the album, of course, Katie Cruel. Why did you decide to include that? Were you a fan of Karen Dalton?
I heard Katie Cruel a couple of years back, and it's just one of those songs. I think it's still one of my favorite songs of all time. It's just one of those songs that really hits you hard. And I still remember the first time I heard it, I was like, what is this? Like, who is this chick? Like, I have to, and I listened to it on repeat, like obsessively. I just became so obsessed with that song. And I don't know, something about, well, Karen Dalton's voice on the record and her banjo playing, it's just incredible, and there's something really haunting about it. And after that, I just kind of, like, I was interested about Karen Dalton, and then just research a bit of her story, and it's quite tragic, and so the character kind of fit really well with her, and somehow I kind of found myself in that character, or could easily see a lot of people that I knew like kind of be transformed into that character. So it's just, you know, I just got attached to that tune and really, really wanted to cover it, and just decided to put it on that EP.
What's it like for you performing somebody else's song compared to one of your own?
It's nice. I like it. I've always liked, I actually used to do a lot of cover shows. That's how I started out, and I've always loved doing covers. We always incorporate some of them in our shows, and it's just like one of my favorite moments. It's another thing, and you get to really just, you know, kind of have fun with it, and also see another character and try to, you know, be in her shoes or whatever. So it's a nice challenge. I've always loved it, and yeah, especially for Katie Krull.
You're obviously from New Brunswick, which is very interesting culturally, and in, you know, especially in terms of Canada. What has that done for you, do you think, in terms of your creative process, if any?
A lot. I owe a lot of, well, who I am right now because of where I'm from, which is, you know, normal. But I'm from a really, really small town called Roserville, and it's really in the middle of nowhere in New Brunswick. And I love it. I think it's great out here. And there's been, like, I'm Acadian too, so I mean, there's this whole other culture. It's French culture that exists. That it's been so great to just kind of bathe in that, just like growing up. And a lot of people from Rogersville here are musicians, and it's fun. Just came back from a huge bluegrass festival that was going on in Rogersville, and it's one of my favorite festivals of all time, and I still can't believe it. I mean, it's in my hometown, and there's so many great musicians, like, all over the place. Just, like, pitch a rock and you hit a musician, so, I mean, everybody wants to jam all the time. Not a lot of people do it as for a living, so when people are playing music, it's for a hobby, it's for fun, and it's on, you know, what are we going to do? There's not much to do anyway, so why not get a bunch of people and do a kitchen party? So I'm from that culture, and I've always loved playing music because it was a hobby at first. So yeah, no, I've learned a lot coming from this small town and being Acadian, and just also Moncton is all, I've lived in Moncton for a while, and I just love it. There's such a nice community over here, and there people are great, people are very welcoming, and you can learn a lot from different musicians around here, and I just find it great.
It seems that there's something about small towns, especially in that part of Canada, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, where there's a lot of Kayleys and house parties, that seems to have a higher concentration of musicians or artists than perhaps other parts of the country. What do you think it is about that part of the world that just has this rich cultural history to it?
Well, I mean, like, Acadians, I'm talking about Acadians because that's what I know. I mean, the Maritimes in general, I mean, there's all this whole Irish and, you know, the Celtic movement, and just a lot of folk, a lot of traditional stuff. It's something that, you know, people here were very poor and didn't really have anything much to do, or didn't really have any money to buy anything. So I mean, music has been extremely important in, and also like a the church and everything, and it just, like, it's something that there's a lot of gatherings, and people love to have a good time. Acadians really like to party and they love music, and it's the same thing as when I was in Louisiana. Like, I spent a lot of time in Louisiana, and the Cajuns are very, very similar, so you can kind of find that culture. Just, you know, there's a very nice connection to do with it. Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of musicians. We didn't have much to do, and we're very proud of our culture and our heritage. So I mean, it's just like a melting pot of a lot of things that make us who we are, I guess.
I read on your website that you describe yourself as folk trash. How would you describe what that is to us Westerners?
Folk trash is just like until I was just tired of saying I was playing folk rock, so I wanted to like make it a little more interesting, and so I called like my music folk trash. That's pretty much it, yeah. But it actually fits pretty well with what we do, especially live, because I mean there's a very like the root of the thing is very, you know, country bluegrass, pretty blue stuff. But I play with two guys, one a drummer and a baritone guitarist. So we really, and we love playing loud, and we're all old mill heads. So it's kind of like we kind of have like this little punk rock energy like that we love to have on stage. And so it's like punk rock-ish, well, not really, but with a banjo, if you mind.
And finally, would you say that you have a favorite song off of Highways, Heartaches, and Time Well Wasted?
Maybe The Waiting List?
Okay.
Yeah, that would probably... Or maybe You Look Like Trouble, but I guess I do too. I'm just kind of like, there's something about that too, that since it's what kind of started the whole thing out, I have this special attachment to it, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it's a nice little album. I had a chance to listen to it. Lisa, thanks so much for your time today.
Well, thank you so much.
Alrighty, have a good one. Cheers.
Take care. See ya.
This is Lisa LeBlanc with her version of Katie Krewel.
Yeah.